Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock at KTOO, and this is Pat Moore, guest hosting today for a Juno Afternoon. Today on the show, we'll get details on tonight's Evening at Egan presentation by Dr. Thomas King. Lance Twitchell will be here with those details. Barney McClure will be here to highlight this week's cabaret concert, Singing in the Rain. We'll talk with author Anna Maria Spagna about tonight's library presentation and Saturday's writing workshop. And we'll find out about the JDHS production of The Curious Savage with director Michelle Moore. All that, Writer's Almanac, music, and more today at 3 on KTOO News. The weather forecast for the rest of today, mostly cloudy, scattered rain showers, highs around 45, southeast winds 10 miles per hour, and tonight cloudy, rain likely late, lows around 37, southwest winds 10 miles per hour.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. ABC Television is airing a special tonight that looks at children on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. The show is part of a series hosted by journalist Diane Sawyer. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Tonight's broadcast is A Hidden America, Children of the Great Plains. Promotional announcements for tonight's program describe Native children living in poverty in the shadows of Mount Rushmore. During the program, Diane Sawyer visits with some of the 40,000 people who live on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation. Sawyer profiles a 12-year-old girl learning to speak the Lakota language while living in what's being called an extremely unstable home life. Viewers will also meet an 18-year-old scholarship recipient with dreams of becoming an architect and a football quarterback who wants to become the first Native American president. Sawyer also visits with law enforcement officials and school and business leaders who look to change conditions on the reservation. Tonight's show airs on ABC TV in the time slot occupied by the network's 2020 program. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
U.S. Senator John Barrasso introduced a bill Wednesday to make it easier for tribes to control energy production on their lands. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports, there still would not be a level playing field.
If American Indian tribes want to lease their land or enter into business agreements with energy developers, they need to get permission from the federal government. Until now, no tribes have done so, in part because there are so many bureaucratic hoops to jump through. Barrasso's bill would simplify that process. Jose Agudo is an energy policy advisor for the National Congress of American Indians. He says the bill is a good step, but the tribes would still be at a disadvantage when it comes to energy production.
There is currently a $6,500 fee for an application for a permit to drill in Indian country. And for example, in the state of Montana, on non-tribal lands, that fee is $25.
Agudo says tribes also have to get their land appraised by the Department of the Interior before energy development can begin, whereas non-tribal lands can be appraised by third parties, which is faster. For National Native News, I'm Willow Belden.
In Alaska, North Slope communities are out for fall whaling. As Lori Townsend reports, so far the results have been mixed.
Johnny Aiken is the executive director of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission in Barrow. Aiken says Barrow crews have landed only two whales so far this fall.
The crews out that are out boating have not been seeing as many whales as they used to this time of the year.
But he says the villages of Koktovik and Nuiqsut have had great success.
Koktovik landed all their whales, all three of them. And also Nuiqsut also landed three whales. So those two villages have been very successful.
Aiken says Nuiqsut crews landed large whales. All three averaged 50 feet, which translates into around 50 tons per whale. Aiken says the weather has been rough, making it difficult for barrel crews to get out. He says the lack of fall ice makes it more dangerous.
We have not seen any ice in the fall for, 10 years. In the past, we used to have ice, and it was good to have ice because it kept the seas calm. Now that we don't have ice, it's been pretty rough out there.
AEWC has 11 member villages that share between 72 and 75 strikes each year for the spring and fall whaling season. For National Native News, I'm Lori Townsend in Anchorage.
During this week in 2010, President Obama signed into law the Indian Veterans Housing Opportunity Act. It made changes to certain Native American housing programs Native veterans, their families, and survivors were being denied low-income housing assistance due to an oversight that had allowed veterans' disability and survivor benefits to count as income. The new law fixed that flaw. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding by the Washington, D.C. and Alaska law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, defending Native American interests throughout the United States. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3 in the afternoon. I'm Pat Moore, guest hosting today for Jeff on Juno Afternoon. My first guest today is a pianist and organ player of some major renown. Barney McClure is here with us. Barney, tell us about why you're in Juno.
Hey, I'm back again. This is actually my ninth session here. And once again, I'm back to do the Singing in the Rain Cabaret. And it opens tonight. Our big concert is tonight after a week-long session with working with singers.
Now, when you say singers, you're not actually talking about imported talent from the outside world. We're talking about folks from Juno, right?
That's right. Your friends, your neighbors, your workmates, your family, you're going to see somebody on that stage tonight that you know. And, it's they're not professionals. Very few do I. First of all, there probably aren't a lot of opportunities to be professional singers in Alaska at large. And so they're just people who have always wanted to sing and finally get the courage up to do so.
Now, you've worked with this group of singers that we're going to hear from tonight for a period of time on a song that they chose, or...
They come to me with two or three ideas what they'd like to do, and between us we narrow it down to one or perhaps two. Depending on the number of people we have performing, we have 20 participants this year. I've had as many as 31 or 32. That's high. Makes for a long show. But we have 20 this time, and sometimes they occasionally get to do two pieces.
Now, they start with you, they're with you for a week. When did this start for these folks?
Sunday night, in earnest, yeah.
And what went on Sunday night?
The same thing that goes on every night. We get up to the piano. Of course, it starts off really personal and intimate. They come stand close to the piano, and they don't have to sing onto a microphone, nor do they have to have the attention of all the rest of their peers out in the classmates. But... then as the week unfolds and they start getting more experience handling a microphone, how to get on and off the stage, how to introduce their tune. There's a lot of factors to it that make for the presentation of one tune, and we work on their tune. The challenge to them and what this is really all about is to take a tune and make it theirs, to tell the message of the tune, and to make it unique. We try to do very few record covers. And the other challenge is it has to be a tune they have not performed locally anywhere before.
So some of the people have been on stage at other times around town.
I don't know all of their personal histories, of course, but the standard is, and I do a lot of these cabarets, generally, most of the people are, I would say a good 60-70% of them have never been on stage or in front of a microphone before.
So there's a certain amount of mic fright that you have to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to the business of making the tune theirs. Can you give me an example of what you might do to a song to take ownership?
That's a really good question, because it's each one is a personal challenge to me and for them as well. And a lot of people will come to me having learned some tune that they've heard some pop singer do, and they want to do it exactly that way, and that's where we differ. First of all, I'm only a piano player. I'm not a whole band or orchestra. And second of all, the whole premise here is that this is about them and their talent showing through. There has to be a reason why they chose the song more than that they liked the way it was recorded. And so we try to get into the heart of what the song is about. Cabaret comes from a time in history when we have this image of Chanteuses singing in smoky nightclubs in Europe pre-World War II, but at a time when American music was highly discouraged by some corrupt governments. And people like Marlene Dietrich come to mind, and in any event, that style. Well, that style was personalizing a song, taking a song maybe that fits you, but singing a song about. Participants are encouraged to get into the song to the extent if they want to dress the dress of whatever this song is about, great. They also learn a little bit about introducing their song, talking to the people. It's just a broader perspective on how to get up and turn something into a win.
So you work on these aspects of the performance for from Sunday through Friday night.
Correct.
You've had your last workshop already?
We had
our
dress rehearsal last night.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and now did you teach today then as well?
No, today I took it off. Generally, okay. There's a lot of other wrap-up things that I have to take care of that have been pushed to the end of the week.
Okay. So then Saturday night, when the 20 singers come out to perform their pieces.
What? So Friday night.
No, Friday night. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. Friday night. When they perform the tonight. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When they come out on stage, now what can we expect? What will they do? They'll talk to the audience for a minute or two?
Well, surprisingly, 20 people can take up some time. So one thing is I'm moving it along pretty quickly. So they're poised and ready to come on stage. One of their challenges is to try to get to the microphone before the applause dies after I've introduced them, so they can get over the dynamics of handling a microphone. If they're going to move it, if they're going to take it out of the holder, and those kinds of things. Those kinds of things make noise, and so you'd like to get those kinds of things taken care of before the applause dies. If you were up there for doing 7 or 8 songs, it's a one-time issue, but for them, it's moving along pretty quickly. So that's the process. one singer right after another, in a way, just to keep a show entertaining, moving, and get people home at a decent time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with 20 singers in a row, it could get, if anybody took a long time to introduce their
imagine
piece.
30 or 31 or two. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you said you've done these in other places as well?
Well, it's an Alaskan phenomenon as far as I know.
Okay.
Because I'm not asked to do it in other states. I travel as a performer all over the globe. But it's only in Alaska where this is a phenomenon. I do it in Fairbanks and in Nome and a couple other places, and it's very popular. I don't know why it's not done elsewhere.
Can you draw any contrast between your experience with the singers in that you've coached in other communities? Is it different in Juneau in any way?
Yeah. Yeah, Juneau always going to loosen my collar thinking, this is going to be different. Because there's a real high quotient of personalities here. And it's always fun.
As opposed to, do you have to develop that personality in other places?
No, I'm just talking about characters. Really,
I see.
Let their hair down and have a good time. Yeah.
So I guess that arises from the fact that we're a fairly theatrical town. There's a lot of opportunities in this town.
So, yeah. I'm so impressed. A small community like this and all of the arts, performing arts that go on here. It could be that. It could be the sense of community. It could be just it takes a certain kind of person to have decided this is home. Who knows? But I do find a high degree of zaniness here. I love it. I look forward to it.
Yeah. And it's different than the other places that you do this.
Each place is unique onto its own. Nome is always some kind of a surprise, too. But it's different. I really look forward to every one of them. They're all neat.
How many of these do you do a year?
Three or four.
I see. And then during the rest of the year, you said you're performing in all kinds of places?
Right. I've always been a performer, a jazz pianist, and organist, as you said.
Right. You play the Hammond.
Hammond B3.
Which is a unique instrument that now is starting to disappear. Hammond doesn't make them anymore.
They stopped in 1964. They're trying to remake them. They're not the instrument they used to be. They're all digitalized, of course, and there's some loss of authenticity there. I have one, and Juno Jazz and Classics owns one. And, in fact, I'll be back in May as a guest artist for the Juno Jazz and Classics this year. I was here in 2003 in that capacity. And I'll be performing with my own trio, and I'll also be backing Dee Daniels, a vocalist who will be here at that time. And during that period of time, I'll be on the Hammond B3.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Barney, the concert tonight starts at
7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. The tickets are going fast.
It's in the Jack?
It is.
Okay. And so the tickets are available, I think, at the bookstores, online from the Arts Association, and at the Jack.
Yes, I...
So, but someone said that it's starting to get close to a sellout, so
yeah.
I think people should pay attention a little bit.
Yeah, but I still encourage people to try to get there if they're going to see someone they know up there.
Uh-huh. Underneath us, slowly fading up right now, is your recording of Laura. Can you tell us a little bit about when you did this?
In 1983 was the recording. Bud Shank, a very famous saxophonist, is on it, as is Jeff Hamilton, the drummer, bass player. Everybody on it were stellar players that I knew, their friends, and they all jumped aboard to help me out. Not much else I can tell you. I thought the thing had died and gone away, but it's now been released re-released as a CD.
Wonderful. Barney, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I think the appropriate thing to say to you and the 20 singers is break a leg, right?
No, not to a jazz musician. Never say that.
Oh,
no,
I won't.
That's
say
exactly
that.
What we'll do.
Okay.
To say, don't forget your check at the end of the night.
Well, don't forget your check at the end
All
of the
right.
night. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
Music there by Barney McClure, our guest, first guest today on Juno Afternoon. Barney will be bringing on 20 singers this evening in a performance starting at 7 o'clock in the Jack. They've been working on their performances all week. Someone else has been working on a performance all week as well, and two folks from UAS are here to talk to us about it. In the studio, I have Lance Twitchell and Nate Mulak. And they're going to tell us about not only the King lecture that's coming up tonight and reading, but also a couple of other events that are related to that. Welcome.
Thank you, Pat. We're really excited. We're excited that Dr. King is here and also his partner, Helen Hoy. Thomas King is an award-winning author. I think it's a fantastic opportunity for our students and our community to see someone of his level come to our campus. So it's been really exciting hanging out with him the last day or so and just getting to know him this morning he did a reading of some of his short stories, and we were just talking, his work is just, his short stories are hilarious, but it's humor that's directed at some very serious and pressing issues, especially that have to do with Native American history and also current Native American sort of social issues. And so I like the way that he's able to do those things. So you're laughing, but then you're also thinking quite seriously about something that he's just talked about, like the adoption of American Indian children out of families into non-Native families. But tonight he's going to be reading some of his more serious work from a book that he wrote called The Truth About Stories, which is a really, it's a fantastic book. It's a piece of what I would say probably creative nonfiction, because it continues to incorporate traditional Native American oral literature into philosophies, Native history, the reasons behind storytelling. And one of the lines that's continually repeated in there is, stories are all we are, which is a really fascinating concept.
Now, the students at the University of Alaska Southeast have been reading this book since the beginning of the semester. It was passed out during registration to all incoming freshmen, I believe.
Right.
This is a program that was started, I think, a year ago as a sort of a campus reading discussion. Were you involved in that, Tay?
No, actually, but the book has been distributed throughout campus, and a lot of people are really excited about this book here. Some of the classes on campus are required to read it as well, so we've got a lot of students coming to a lot of the events the last couple of days, really excited about what they've read and excited to meet Thomas.
Yeah, Wendy Gervin, I think, from the library staff suggested this program, I think, about a year ago,
mm-hmm.
and they read a book together last year that was about people telling their stories. An organization that had gone around the country, I think, and had recorded stories, and then some of these were transcribed into a book that all of the students read together, and then they actually did that kind of collection of stories at one point. And then this year, this was the book.
Correct. And it's really, I think, fascinating to start a semester with one book that's sort of the focus, especially for new incoming students. Then you have a number of faculty who are incorporating it into a number of different classes. And so now you've got everyone sort of having these same discussions as well. And I think this is a fantastic text for that, because it gets us thinking about the reason why we tell stories, what stories make us. For example, Thomas was talking today that when he comes to Juneau, he doesn't have any stories about this place, and he's hungry for stories about this place so he can just get to know people. And this is especially true if you say you move to a place, then you're just hungry for stories about the place and for people to know the stories about you. And so that's one of the philosophies behind stories are all we are. And so as we look at that, it gives us something to have this sort of extended discussion throughout the semester. And then the fantastic part is, here's the author. What do you want to ask him about this now that we've been talking about this? And so it's been in classrooms. We've had brown bag discussions in the library. And the staff at UAS has just been fantastic as far as organizing different events that help prepare our campus and hopefully our community for this event, because we would really like to see a lot of people down there tonight. It's at 7 p.m. in the Egan Library, and it's just ongoing efforts to really bridge the campus and the community, which I think is fantastic.
Tay, did you work with Dr. King while he was here?
We just came from a luncheon that we had, the Wuchin Club on mm-hmm. campus. We hosted a luncheon and invited him in to try some of our traditional foods and had a small discussion. It was just a little luncheon. It was really awesome.
What did you serve?
Well, we had some traditional muktuk or mungtuk, which was from St. Lawrence Island. One of our students brought it in. And we had some smoked hulagan, some half-dried seal meat, and taquitos.
The traditional Tlingit taquito,
right?
Yeah. I'm not sure I've had those. maybe we could open a restaurant. And
oh, yeah. I think they'd go over
sort
really
of a
well.
Fusion affair, right? Well, wonderful. It sounds like you've really welcomed him to the community.
Yeah.
Have you helped him collect stories while he's here? Or are you telling your stories to him?
We're telling stories, and it's really neat because humor is such a part of his way of, I think, navigating through the stories of the world. And it's really interesting to take a look at that and see that, because we were just talking, or actually I was transcribing a conversation between these Tlingit elders, and they were saying, long time ago, talking funny was a part of our culture. You know, and they're really talking about the aspect of that, because if you get into a Tlingit immersion program, it's silly jokes probably 70% of the time. And it's really interesting to take a look at humor and to look at social catastrophe and say, we're going to approach this and it's going to be funny, but it's also a very serious subject. But one thing that Helen and Thomas have talked about is they've been impressed by the number of Tlingit speakers that they've been able to encounter. So luckily at the events that we've had, we have our students like Ney and Ricky Tagband and others who can speak and who are learning to speak our language. And then we also have elders who are there who can also deliver oratory. Like if you get two or three Tlingit speakers in the room and someone gets up and starts moving into that oratory space, then there's certain things that have to happen and it becomes ceremonial. And it was really, I think, fortunate for them to see that. And that's what they've responded. They said they were really curious about Alaska and they wanted to see all these things, but this was probably the one place where they've heard a lot of indigenous language spoken, and they said it was fantastic. And so we were really fortunate to have Nora Dauenhauer and David Katzik and some others with us for that. And so another thing is Helen's going to be talking, and she's done some really interesting work with Native American literature, but also looking at the language and the way that the imagery that's sort of created around fetal alcohol effects. And so, again, another pretty serious subject. And so we're hoping that events like this evening at the Egan and other things that are going on campus will just open the door for these extended conversations to continue to talk about this stuff.
Tay, you're fluent?
No, I'm in my third year studying at UAS, though.
I see. Did you speak it at home when you were going? Did you hear it at home?
I heard small phrases or just a few words, but nobody in my family spoke Tlingit when I was growing up.
So that it must be strange to be, jumping back in from a generation or two out.
No, it actually feels really good. It doesn't feel strange to me. It feels really good. It feels good in my heart and it feels good in my mind to be able to speak a language that my grandfather hadn't spoken since he was a really young boy. So it feels really good to be able to bring that back into my family.
Was your grandfather one of the ones that were discouraged from speaking the language in the schools?
Yes. His first language was Tlingit, and he spoke it up until he went to boarding school. Mm-hmm. And then when he came back, he couldn't speak it anymore.
That was a very cruel period in Alaskan history when we did that to Native speakers. Well, what will happen at the program tonight? Do you have a sense of what Dr. King, and I'm assuming Helen is participating in this too?
Yeah,
what will they be doing?
I think Dr. Helen Hoy will be there as well. And so there'll be a talk by Dr. King and then also by Dr. Hoy. And so one thing that he's continued to stress is he had a literary reading today, and his stories, he said, some people have a hard time because they're kind of goofy. You know, they really get absurd, and that's how I think. But the way he talked about it, he said he was trying to talk about all these different issues, and he said two things would happen. Is one, people would sort of, you can almost see them, their head being drawn back into their shoulders like a turtle. And then he said you knew that you were losing them. But he said politicians would start to smile real big. And then you knew that you were losing, they were done. And so he said, I need to figure out a new way to deal with this. And so humor was his way to deal with it. And so, and he was saying with that fine line where you write something that's so ridiculous that people don't get any meaning from it. But I don't think that's the case because we're laughing, but we're realizing that we're laughing because this absurd story is also true. It's based out of truth. And so it's a really interesting concept. But what he's going to be talking about tonight, I think he's been warning us, it'll be more serious. It's a more serious, he said, we've had all the fun we're going to have. But I don't think so. I think you can talk about serious social issues and do it in a way that gets us to think collectively about how we can start doing things maybe a little bit differently, or at least with a lot more awareness about things that are done socially that really wound people. And so we'll be looking probably at things like that. And then after the event, we're going to go up to the Noise Pavilion, and there's going to be a gathering of the drums. And both Dr. King and Dr. Hoy are very excited about it because they're used to seeing a southern style of dancing around a large drum, whereas up here we have a very different style. And so that's going on tonight. So we've got 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and the campus is going to be a really fun place tonight.
So the beginning of this is in the library where they usually are, or is it in the theater?
Yes, it's in the library.
In the library. In the library. Okay, and that's at 7 o'clock, mm-hmm. Down where the big grand piano is on the first floor, on the ground floor. And then at 9 o'clock, those who want to go across to Noise Pavilion can stay. Is everyone invited to the
Yeah, everyone's invited. There's going to be drums provided. You can bring a drum if you have it. You can listen. You can participate. There's going to be a fire. There'll be warm drinks. You know, we know that winter's coming.
Yes.
But we have to celebrate our evenings outside while we still
So folks
can.
Who are coming to Dr. King's lecture, if they decide to stay for the other thing, should bring warm clothing tonight because it is going to get pretty chilly. I think the forecast is for lows around 37 tonight. So we'll know we're outdoors.
That's right. Yeah. But we're tough.
Okay. But we're Southeast Alaskans after all, the people who never wear raincoats, you know. Anyway.
And I brought Nay along as well because there's a number of other things going on. That Wuchin is our native student group. It's our oldest student group on campus, and they've got a number of events going on.
Nay, we have a couple of minutes. Can you tell us about those events?
Absolutely. So Gathering of the Drums is tonight. It starts at 9 o'clock, and we will have fry bread as well as hot drinks to stay warm. But we've done it in the dead of winter. We've done it in the middle of December, and we still hang out around the fire and have a really good time. So a good time is guaranteed. We have Native History Month coming up next month, and we have a lot of great events starting off with a kickoff on the November 1st, which is a Tuesday, and we're celebrating Native languages. That starts at 7 o'clock. We also have a celebrating storytelling on November 5th, which is a Saturday at 6. And we have guests like Della Cheney, and we're hoping Ernestine Hayes will show up and read with us for a little while as well.
Oh, wonderful. Well, Lance Twitchell, you're an instructor with the Alaska Native Studies Program.
That's correct.
And Nay, a student at UAS.
Yep.
Are you in the Native Studies Program, or what are you studying?
My main focus is Tlingit language, but I am in Lance's Alaska Native Cultures class.
Oh, okay, good.
And we have a film series that's ongoing, so I just want to remind everyone out there. Next week on Thursday, we're seeing Drums of Winter, which is a fantastic film about Yupik culture, and it goes every 2 weeks on Thursday nights. It's in the Egan Lecture Hall, 7 o'clock. It's free. Wuchin has begun providing fry bread, and our student group Waka is providing a guduk. And so if you haven't had either of those things, you should really have them. If you have, you should
Amazing.
Have more. And you should watch the films. We go every 2 weeks. We're doing a Yupik film, an Inuit film, an Athabaskan film, and then we come back with the triple header for Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much for telling us all of this.
You bet. Good as cheese.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 14th of October, 2011. It was on this day, 1926, Winnie the Pooh by A.A. Milne was published. He was a writer for the magazine Punch. Many of his first children's poems and stories were printed there, and not intended for children, but for adult readers. The first Pooh's story was published in the London Evening News Christmas Eve 1925, broadcast on the BBC the next day. Even though A.A. Milne based the Winnie the Pooh stories on his son, Christopher Robin, and his son's stuffed bear, he did not ever read the stories aloud to the boy. He preferred to read his boy the novels of P.G. Woodhouse. The book Winnie the Pooh, which begins, "Here is Edward Bear coming downstairs now, bump, bump, bump on the back of his head behind Christopher Robin. It is, as far as he knows, the only way of coming downstairs, but sometimes he feels that there really is another way if only he could stop bumping for a moment and think of it." It's the birthday of the poet E.E. Cummings, Edward Estlin Cummings, born in Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1894. who, though experimental, modernist poet, when he died in 1962, Cummings was the second most read poet in the country, after Robert Frost. E.E. Cummings, who once wrote about his father, "My father is the principal figure of my earliest remembered life. His illimitable love was the axis of my being." He was a New Hampshire man, 6'2", a crack shot, a famous fly fisherman, first-rate sailor, a woodsman who could find his way through forests primeval without a compass, a canoeist who'd still paddle you up to a deer without ruffling the surface of a pond, an ornithologist and taxidermist, an expert photographer, an actor who portrayed Julius Caesar in Sanders Theater, and a painter, both in oils and watercolors, and a plumber who, just for the fun of it, installed his own waterworks, and while still at Harvard, a teacher with small use for professors, a preacher who horribly shocked his pew holders by crying, "The kingdom of heaven is no spiritual roof garden, it's inside you." And my father had the first telephone in Cambridge, and my father was a servant of the people who fought Boston's biggest and crookedest politician fiercely all day. And my father's voice was so magnificent that he was called on to impersonate God from Beacon Hill. Here's a poem by E.E. Cummings on his birthday, "You Shall Above All Things Be Glad and Young." You shall above all things be glad and young, for if you're young, whatever life you wear, it will become you. And if you are glad, whatever's living will yourself become. Girl boys may nothing more than boy girls need. I can entirely her only love, whose any mystery makes every man's flesh put space on, and his mind take off time. That you should ever think, may God forbid, and in his mercy your true lover spare. For that way knowledge lies, the fetal grave called progress, and negation's dead undoom. I'd rather learn from one bird how to sing than teach 10,000 stars how not to dance. A poem by E.E. Cummings, "You Shall Above All Things Be Glad and Young," from 100 selected poems published by Grove Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can follow them on Twitter at Poetry Found, and by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas, and by the PBS Arts Fall Festival, with Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS. Written by Betsy Alistair, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 20 minutes to 4. My next guest is a woman who has, over the last, I guess, 2 weeks or so, become a friend of mine, and I just met her. Ana Maria España wrote a wonderful collection of essays called Potluck, and she's also written a couple of other books as well. And Ana Maria is here in town and is going to be talking at the library tonight, and then you'll be doing a workshop tomorrow. Is that...
That's correct. Tonight at the library at 7 o'clock, I'll be doing a reading from Potluck, and then tomorrow morning, a workshop at the library as well, called Where Stories Converge. It's about telling multiple stories at once in a nonfiction narrative and a personal narrative.
You know, my previous guests were two people from the University of Alaska Southeast who are hosting Dr. Thomas King in town, who is a Native American Indian storyteller. And so it's a wealth of story tonight.
It is a wealth of story.
You have to make a hard choice. But Potluck is a kind of, I'm not sure exactly how you describe it. It's a book of essays, but they're all to a point. And your point was community. And I suspect that you probably approach almost everything this way. At least I drew that conclusion from your writing, that you aren't sure exactly where you want to come down on this because it's so complex an issue. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely. I see essay writing as a meandering, as a trying to make sense or trying to figure out what you think about this or that. I once heard the wonderful writer Kim Stafford speak, and he was talking about that This American Life program. I'm not This American, the NPR program, This I Believe.
Ah.
And he said he doesn't care for it much, that he wishes there were one called This I Wonder. And I thought, well, that's sort of how I approach essay writing. It's not what I believe. It's what I wonder about community or about the various issues that come up.
Yeah. There was a moment in the midst of my reading when I was thinking to myself, okay, so she's coming to a point, mm-hmm. and then you go someplace else and come back to that point from another direction because it was clear that you were trying to use this as a way to think through what it was that had happened to you, what it was that life was meaning at the moment.
That's it, exactly. It's just I see it as, the old Montaigne, to try to make sense in an essay. And I'm always, as soon as I feel myself coming to a firm conclusion, I sort of back up and come at it from another direction to see if that shines new light on the idea.
I guess we should tell folks that Ana Maria lives in a town, used to live there, I think,
I
right?
I do, I live
in a place called Stehekin, western part of Washington off of Lake Chelan, right?
That's correct. It's at the north end of Lake Chelan and is only accessible by, like a lot of places in Alaska, by ferry boat or by float plane or walking in. It's not an island, but it's a landlocked community of about 100 year-round residents.
And of all crazy things to do, you imported juniper logs to build a cabin in the midst of the fire zone.
We did, indeed. We did indeed, but as penance, I ran for fire commissioner, so and I'm a volunteer firefighter.
And
so
typically wrote a wonderful essay about not being sure if you should have done that.
That's right. I'm not sure public office is for me, but I do my darndest.
So much of your writing impressed me as a person who was trying really hard to be honest. It seemed to me that there were many places in the book where I could almost hear you tearing up the sheet and saying no, because you looked at it after you read it. And said, no, that's not the way it is, and had to rewrite it. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. And it's all the writers I admire the most seem to do that. I'm a huge fan of James Baldwin and his essays on civil rights. And he does the same thing. He says, well, maybe this is what it is. This is the most honest I can be. And then he sort of says, no, it's not, and goes another level deeper. And so I aspire to that. So if you found that reading the book, I take that as a compliment.
So much of the book was about the community of Stehekin and your feelings as you found the place and moved to it, and then eventually it became your home and like that. But in the process of that, there was a more intimate community being formed between you and Laura. Lori?
Lori, yes.
Lori, mm-hmm. yes. And I wondered, I asked you before we started this if you would read a little to us. Could you give us that little section about the moment in your life when you understood your relationship with Lori?
I'd be delighted to do that. We've been renting a cabin in Stehekin for the winter. We didn't have enough firewood. So the only intro you need is that it's been awfully cold in this cabin. She was reading her journal to me and started to shiver as much from self-exposure as from cold. And I didn't know how to deal with that. That's such an intimate moment. And I'll begin reading right there. From under my layers of accumulated blankets, I could see a swath of unmasked stars, such a rare sight, and I could hear Lori's teeth chattering. Any other time, I may have been cautious or prudent. I may have considered the consequences, what Lori might think, for starters. But that winter, I was accustomed to leaping first and looking later. I crawled out of my bed to lie on top of her bed covers and try to warm her, and after a while, I began to shiver. So when I went back to my nest on the floor, Lori came to warm me. This time, finally, it only made sense for us both to get under the covers. We lay spooned together, tense and perfectly still, and we held hands, our fingers cupped lightly, one in the other like newly broken eggshells, and the adrenaline swoop in my chest felt like dropping down the fall line in my dream, delicious and nearly as real as skiing the Mojave. Except that right then, I knew this was not nearly real, but really real. What's more, I knew I'd always known. Slowly, in silence, we began to trace the icy cold tendons along the backs of our thumbs, and our movements were both tentative and sure, and the adrenaline rush softened, and warmth spread from the tingly peaked fingertips out through the whole of me, and I could tell the whole of Lori and the whole lovely valley and the wide universe, too. I could hear my own heart beat strong and fast and loud, and I could hear the roof settling under snow weight, and I don't think I slept as we held hands, but instead just kept falling, chest in my throat, the way you do in a dream, when you know you will never, ever hit bottom, because if you do, you will die.
Mm-hmm. And your roommate, Larry, came in the morning and tried to bring you both coffee and tore out of the room
in
fright.
He was a little surprised, yes.
And then I loved the fact that the next morning you both got up and without speaking skied off in separate directions because you both had to absorb what was going on between you.
Well, it was absolutely terrifying. We hadn't foreseen that happening. And what else do? You run away first.
How hard was that to write?
It was very hard to write. It was very hard to enter that moment and to try to be as raw as you possibly can and to share something that's that very intimate. But, of course, it's at the core of, you know, who I am and who we are and how we became part of the place that we love and the community that we love.
And so you built the house together and are still living in it.
We built the house together, and we still live in it in Stehekin. Lori maintains a historic apple orchard there for the Park Service.
Maintains it from the bear incursions.
From the bears, yes. There's an essay in the book called Woman Who Gardens with Bears, and that's about the gist of it. I'd imagine Alaskans can appreciate that. And I worked on a trail crew for the Park Service until 6 years ago when my first book came out, and at that point I was able to scab together a living just writing and teaching online and doing day labor in the community as necessary.
And doing the occasional writing workshop and reading in Juneau, Alaska.
Which is an absolute delight and privilege, of course.
Wonderful. So now you're reading tonight at what time?
I'm reading tonight at 7 at the library.
Okay.
And the workshop is, again, tomorrow morning from 9 until noon on braiding together different storylines in a nonfiction narrative.
Is there
narrative.
Any charge for the workshop?
I don't believe there is.
I don't think there is either.
But I believe you should pre-register if you can.
Yeah, yeah. Because there's limited space in the room that you're
Absolutely.
Working in. Okay, so 9 till noon tomorrow.
Yes.
7 o'clock until...
Probably 8 or 8:30 tonight.
8 or 8:30 tonight.
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful.
Yep.
Well, thank you. Welcome to Juneau. It's a delight to finally meet you now that I've met you twice, once in the book and once in your delightful person.
So. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. Bye.
Get off the bus and I can see my breath. The air is so cold that you could freeze to death. I turn up my collar and the wind starts to blow. And the sky turns gray and it begins to snow. I put down my head, it's only 2 blocks more. I make it to my house and then I open the door. It smells like winter at our house. It smells like winter at our house. It smells like winter in our house. It smells like soup, 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 soup. When my dad was a kid in my grandma's home, she taught him how to start with the old soup bone. You put the water, carrot, celery, and onions in the pot. It only takes a little of whatever you got. There ain't no way to hurry, and my grandma would remind. Anything with waiting for is gonna take time. It smells like winter in our house. It smells like winter in our house. It smells like winter in our house. It smells like soup, 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 soup. All day long I hear it bubbling in the pot. Sneak up to the lid, be careful, it's hot. Lift up the corner and I take a little sniff and then I close my eyes and take a great big whiff. I go and get a tablespoon to steal a little taste. I got a big soup smile all over my face. It smells like winter at our house. It
smells like winter at our house. It smells like winter at our house. It smells like sea soup, chicken soup with macaroni, cream of broccoli, and minestrone soup, potato soup, tomato soup, chowder made of clam, miso soup and mushroom soup, split pea with ham, bouillon scallion, tonka guy with lemongrass, matzo ball, chili bean,
cream of
soup. It doesn't ever matter, let the cold winds blow, let the rivers freeze, and if it's 3 feet of snow, from my dad and from my grandma, it's what I got. They put a whole lot of love in that old black pot. In my mind I see a little boy, a distant winter day, he's standing in my door and I can hear him say, smells like winter in our house. It smells like winter in our house. Oh, it smells like winter in our house. 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 Smells like winter in our house.
Little music off of an album called Winter Song, to sort of take us to our next guests, who are going to tell us about a dramatic presentation that is in final preparation and actually is being played right now at JDHS at the theater. We have Michelle Moore, who is directing the show and is the drama instructor at JDHS. And we have Fairy May, Dr. Emmett, and Lily Bell from the cast, who are in when they step out of the phone booth as they're in their Clark Kent guise, they are Jessica Sullivan, Angela Wright, and Ellen Dyer. So let me start with the actors, the actresses in this thing, and tell me, without giving away the entire plot, give me some idea of the show.
Well, my character, Lily Bell, is the main character, Mrs. Savage. I am her stepdaughter. And the basic premise of the play is that Mrs. Savage has been left money from her deceased husband, and her stepchildren want this money very bad. And so they go through a series of difficulties to acquire this money.
The play takes place actually in a psychiatric clinic.
This is Angela Wright.
Oh, yeah, I'm Angela Wright, by the way. Right. I play Dr. Emmett, and yep, the psychiatric clinic that she ends up in, her stepchildren send her to that one, and it's run by me, the doctor.
And my name in play is Fairy May, and I play one of the patients at the psych ward who is 27 years old but acts very childish and immature and bounces off the walls, basically.
And Michelle, how did you pick this play for the performances?
I picked this play because I have a lot of talented students, and it's one of the plays out there that has 12 leading roles, and the roles are pretty well balanced between male and female, and I really wanted to give a lot of my students an opportunity to be challenged and work on something more mature and something that basically, they were going to learn a lot from the process of becoming these characters and producing the show. And most of the plays out there will have, you know, 4 to 5 leading characters and then really small roles. So that's the main reason I picked this play, to give all of them an opportunity to really dig deep into acting and to shine.
Angela.
Yes.
How prominent is Dr. Emmett in the show? How much are you on stage?
I am on stage kind of in and out throughout the entire play.
Okay.
So I'm also in there, you know, to kind of guide the patients. I end up yelling at the stepchildren a lot. I also interact with Mrs. Savage. I'm her main link between, you know, her and the outside world.
Who's playing Miss Savage?
Cheyenne Silverly is.
Okay. Couldn't join us today, unfortunately.
No, she had a class.
Oh, okay. Well,
I know, right?
I mean, priorities, folks.
Got to pass those classes to be in the play.
And Ellen, now, are you majoring, or you don't major in high school, but how much drama training have you had?
I have, I started out my drama career, I guess, my freshman year in high school with Auntie Mame, and I think I've been in almost every play that we've done at JDHS ever since then, with maybe one exception since then. So I've done a lot over the past couple of years.
And Jessica?
I'm a junior in high school, and I went on exchange last year, so I missed all the plays that year. But I was in one my freshman year and one this year, and I hope to do all the rest after this.
Where'd you go on exchange?
Denmark.
Denmark. Ah, wonderful. Were you on the show when we were talking about exchange
students?
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
I was.
No, okay. Okay. And how about how much drama training have you had?
I have also been in the plays since my freshman year, and I'm a senior this year. So there's been two plays that I wasn't in, but I was involved still within the plays doing stuff. Like, I'd be backstage doing makeup or helping out with props. I was set wrangler for one of them, so, you know, struggling with set pieces. Yeah, so also Ellen and I are both involved in DDF as well, so we've had theater training through there too.
Michelle, what's DDF?
Drama, Debate, and Forensics Team.
Oh, okay.
They're the ones that compete.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And these girls are also a part of my drama classes. They've been in the beginning acting. They've been in the advanced acting, and they're part of my acting company, which is a really special class of ensemble acting. And so they've gotten a lot of training.
These courses are all elective courses in
yes,
the sequence,
they are.
Right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But students in the high school system here are required to take a certain amount of elective.
They're supposed to take, I believe, I can't remember now with the new policy, but yes, they have to have some fine arts credits.
Mm-hmm.
They can take them through theater or music or art.
So are any of you musical or?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, so.
I've been involved in choir pretty much as long as I've been involved in the theater program at JDHS, and I love it so much. I'm in chamber singers. We just had our first concert of the year. Lots of exciting stuff, and I can't wait for the musical because it brings both aspects together, and it's awesome.
So what are the plans for the future? Where will you take this acting experience?
Well, what I would like to do is I would like to go and major in musical theater, see if I can make a career out of it. I'm not sure if that's plausible, but fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The others? Jessica?
Oh, for the future?
Yeah, do you have designs on an acting career?
Not on an acting career. I have so many ideas that it's hard to choose from, but I like to just keep acting on the side for little things, and which would be fun.
And Angela?
Yeah, I as well. I'd love to go into health sciences, but I definitely want to keep doing the local gigs. I want to stay involved in that local theater.
And there's wonderful opportunities in Juneau for local theater.
Oh,
not
yes.
I don't know if you'll be staying here if your plan includes that. But
really great.
We were talking earlier with one of our guests about the incredible range of opportunities there are here. So tell me when we can go see this.
So tonight and tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at the JDHS Auditorium, and tickets are $10 adults, $8 students, and you can buy them at the door.
Okay. $10 adults. How much?
$8 students.
$8 students. Buy them at the door. It's at the JDS Auditorium. Mm-hmm. Showtime is?
7 p.m.
Should show up a little early in order to... Is
yeah,
it open
around 6:30 to 6:45.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Well, break a leg, girls.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Music there to close out the show from Te Vaka. They'll be performing Sunday night at 7 o'clock at the JDHS Auditorium. Tomorrow, or Monday, on KTOO's Juno Afternoon, we'll be talking with Marion Beck, the author of Salmon Patties and the Rosehip Pie Cookbook. And we'll talk with Dorothy Green, Executive Director of Polaris House, about Tuesday's open house. You'll also hear Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. And that's all at 3 o'clock Monday on KTOO. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. in the Valley and Auk Bay, we're on K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we are on K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens to us on K201 AM on 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Straits, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9.